So the thing about chanting is, any of you have known, if I've talked with you before, is everybody can chant. If you can talk, you can chant. So don't worry about how it sounds, just bellow it out. Even if it's just talking without any tune. Born in a Baptist family, and so the first 14 or 15 years of my life I was Baptist, and my parents were involved in the church, and we went to church regularly, went to Sunday school all the time, we knew the songs, and in fact, when I was thinking about a song to sing tonight, I thought, why don't I pull out some of those old songs from my childhood? But when I was around 14, my cousins started looking at Catholicism, and so I was curious about Catholicism, and so I studied it also. And just before I was 16, I became a Catholic, even though the rest of my family was Baptist. And so then I practiced Catholicism from that age, almost 16, until I found Ananda, which was about 30 years, that period of time. Raised my children as Catholics, but for a long time, I knew that there was something that wasn't meeting my needs within the Catholic Church. That was something that, there were certainly beliefs that I just, the Catholics would say that this is the way it is. In fact, most Christians say this is the way it is. And as far as I was concerned, it didn't make sense. And so I was constantly looking for something else. And then I, knew that the Eastern path had more of what I needed. And so then, and I actually, when my oldest daughter was just a tiny baby, I took her to the pediatrician, and the pediatrician said, "Have you ever read Autobiography of a Yogi?" I think I already heard of Yogananda, but I hadn't read it, and I got it when my oldest daughter was a tiny baby and read it and thought, wow, that's really something, and just held on to it. I especially held on to Lahiri Mahashaya on the left side because I knew that he had a family and I had a family, and I thought, you know, if he can do it, I can do it. And that was just one of the things. And so when my girls then got old enough, they went through confirmation and all those things that you do as a Catholic, when they finished all of that, then I said, okay, now it's time for me to find what really works for me. And I knew what it was already. It was just a matter of finding where the church was. And I came to Ananda, and that was it. So I had that strong Christian background, but also within my family, there was also a lot of discussion about religion, and a lot of the discussion was open and broad, and so there was a sense of Eastern approaches to things, and so all of that felt really, really part of me. It felt like it made sense. So part of this class, as you saw before, it's the historical Jesus to the Christ of faith. And so I just wanted to warn you that part of this class may rattle your faith a little bit. Because in looking at historical Jesus, we want to look at what information we really know. And one of the, I'll show you a picture pretty soon, of a man who I used some of this information, and he made this distinction between historical Jesus and Christ of faith. And you can have them both, and I find that, you know, I knew many of the things that he was already saying, I already knew them, but he hits you with it kind of hard, and so I found that I had to sort of take him in smaller doses, but that these two can actually live together, the historical Jesus, that yes, this is true, and no, that really isn't true, that's really myth, and yes, this is true, and no, that's really not true, can live along with the inspiration, the life-changing wisdom and sense of oneness, sense of wonder, all of that that can come from a relationship with Jesus or a relationship with the Christ. So my warning is, okay, this first part might feel kind of rocky, but hang in there. So who is this man Jesus? And what does he look like? And what did he say, really? What did he do? So first of all, you know, we have lots of wondering, portrayals, wondering what did he really look like. And it probably doesn't matter what he really looked like. But he was a man, and that is actually one of the things that researchers, historians are now absolutely agreeing on. He was a man who did live, he lived in that area of Nazareth, that the whole area of the Middle East. And so we just wonder, who is he? And so what we're going to try and do is find out more about that. So this man, Father Jack, was a priest who worked with me and the people that I was with and worked with my family. We were very, very close to him. He was a normal Catholic priest, excepting that my brother-in-law used to call him the renegade priest because his ideas were always way out there. I mean, and he knew the Bible well. And he came to our house for 5 years and did Bible study with us, with myself, my husband, and a small group of people. He worked with the deaf, so in this picture he's actually signing. And it was just fabulous. There were times when I would go to church and he was saying something and I would think, "Do you hear what he's saying? You know, he would say things that were like, wow, is that really true? I'll give you an example that I didn't include in anything else. He talked about, you know, you've heard Mary, Mother of God. Well, first of all, you want to know, what does that mean, Mother of God? How does that work? But he said, Father Jack said, that idea of calling Mary Mother of God came up as a political thing, and it was almost like a litmus test. If you could say Mary was the mother of God, then you really fully accepted that Jesus was God. Because the relationship between Jesus and God the Father was actually in question. In the very beginning, it wasn't absolutely clear of what that relationship was. Now Catholics and other Christians say that, you know, Jesus is part of the Trinity, and Jesus is absolutely God, and Jesus and God are one and the same. Now, as yogis, we can say the same thing, that Jesus and God are one. But we can also say that someday we all will recognize that we actually are that too. We'll recognize that we are one with God. We don't recognize it yet. Jesus already did. Paramahansa Yogananda recognizes it, and then the rest of our gurus. But at the time that people were saying Mary is the mother of God, they didn't have, many of the people didn't have that same understanding. They had a more literal understanding of it. And so, but Father Jack would say something like that in the pulpit, and you would think, whoa, this is really interesting. Say more. So my other information, so I base a lot of what I researched on the things that he said. And then, I researched. And on the internet, you can find some of everything, especially points of view. You can find points of view that you agree with, and you can find points of view that you disagree with, and they all are absolutely true. And, you know, so you have to read, and things that are imagined. I mean, you have to read very, very carefully. So what I did, actually, was the things that Father Jack said that I agreed with, when I found things on the internet that agreed with that, then I accepted it. So that was... not as, I don't know, how can you measure these things? How can you weigh them? But this is the other person who I looked into a lot. Reza Aslan, he lives here now. He actually was born in Iran and came to this country in the 1980s when there was great upheaval. I think that the Ayatollah had returned to Iran and his father said, oh my gosh, we've got to get out of there. And he said his family was, his father was an atheist, a very, very strong atheist, and his mother a lukewarm Muslim. So that was the kind of environment that he was raised in, so not a strong religion at all. And he converted to Christianity in high school from being exposed to some really strong fundamentalist Christians. And did that, and was just, you know, absolutely on fire with Christianity, and a, you know, deep believer, and would go out and talk with people about it. And then he went to Santa Clara University and was taught by the Jesuits. And then he began to see more and more that the things that he thought from his fundamentalist point of view were not actually true. Here were Jesuit priests who also studied the same Bible, who were saying, well, you know, there's another way of interpreting it, just like Jack was saying, for us, Father Jack would say, there's another way of looking at it. You need to look at it this way. What, you know, here's more research on that. And so after that, he decided he was no longer a Christian. He was no longer able to hold on to that. And I think over much, much more time, because he also went to Harvard and majored in theology at Harvard. And so then eventually he actually went back to his roots, back to the Muslim faith, and became, I think, a Sufi now. So anyway, he's on the internet. If you're ever interested in listening to any of his talks, or, you know, the book is interesting, but as I said, because I actually did get the book and listened to the whole thing, and got a lot of information from it. But he really tears apart any, you know, what I wanted to say about what your faith is grounded on. I hope that your faith is grounded on something really solid, because that's where it needs to be. And if these other little stories that are in the Bible that we like, you know, we can still hold on to those stories, but they don't we don't have to take them literally. And so he, if you just listen to him, though, sometimes he will really shake your faith in that sense. Okay, so we are going to travel. I wanted us all to get an idea of where this story takes place. So, Jesus was called the Nazarene, and that's actually one of the things that they know really for sure, because it's said over and over again. One of the things that I've said, seen many times in the Bible, in the my research, is that if something is said in the Bible over and over again, it's probably true. And if it's said once or twice or here and there, then you have to really look at it. Now, that goes for something that's really solid, like Nazarene, you know, because there's a place. But there are other things that are said over and over again that you have to understand what is meant by them, because the words are not clear. Like, the kingdom of God is within you. What does that mean? Whereas when you say that he is a Nazarene, you know that he came from Nazareth. So, and I didn't give you guys maps.
So, some of them. Oh, this one doesn't have a picture of Nazareth. Come on.
Nazareth.
Oh, here it is. Yeah. So there's Nazareth. So that was where his family was from, and where, and he was called a Nazarene, so that's where he did most of his stuff. Bethlehem is all the way down here. And the Bible says that the family traveled from Nazareth, I guess, down to Bethlehem to go. Can you guys see this okay? Is that in the way? The whole thing is not clear. I'm sorry, what?
Today, what are these geographies? Like, what countries?
Yes, this is Israel.
Okay.
I think that's Syria in here. And I have another map thing that will show us more. Judea down here.
And Jordan to the north.
Jordan. Okay, up here. Jordan?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, the Golan Heights, I think I looked at, was down here somewhere. So Israel, basically, right down here. Jerusalem, right there. Bethany will come up in some of our discussion, possibly. Bethsaida and the Sea of Galilee. Now, that doesn't look much like a sea, does it? It looks more like a lake. And the newer translations of the Bible will say the Lake of Galilee instead of the sea. But one of the interesting things is that Father Jack told us that the reason they call it the Sea of Galilee was to make a connection between Jesus and Moses. Because the people, the Jewish people that he was teaching, knew Moses and loved Moses and respected Moses. And the writers of the gospel wanted them to see both Moses, Jesus, Jesus, Moses, these two are really connected. And so they changed some things just in the way that they would call it, just to help you see that connection. And that was one of them. Instead of calling it the Lake of Galilee, which in fact it is, they called it the Sea of Galilee. And so now when the Bible translates it according to what it really is, it misses the point. The point was that the writers wanted the people to see it as the Sea of Galilee and making the connection with the Red Sea that Moses parted. And so this is Old Testament. In the Old Testament, Moses was the person who brought the Jews out of Egypt. And he separated, maybe you've seen Cecil B. DeMille movie, and he separated the Red Sea and so forth. So that was making that connection. Pardon?
What's the name of the movie that
you saw? Cecil B. DeMille's movie, The Ten Commandments. Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Check it out. Okay, so this is just a closer picture. The one circled, I actually didn't do the circles on there, they were already done, but the one on the left is Cana. And we'll be looking at a wedding that happens in Cana. So you can see in Bethsaida is the top one, the Jordan River, just to get an idea of where it all is. Okay. And there we have, I didn't give you guys a copy of this, did I? If you're really, really interested, I can copy these pictures. I have them on paper. What I wanted to say, 33 miles all the way around. You know, for us, you get in your car and you zip. But these guys were on foot or on a donkey. So it helps for us to kind of get an idea. When Jesus goes from one side to the other, you have an idea of how big the whole thing is. 8 miles across, 13 miles long. I don't know how long it would take to go by boat and those things. But okay. So there are a few basic facts that we all agree on about Jesus. One, that he was born in the year 4 before the Common Era. So BC, or what we call nowadays, before the Common Era. Our time is by 0, right? And going forward and 0 and going backwards. But that's because people miscalculated when Jesus was actually born. So it's actually he was born before 0. Do you get what I mean with that? And he was actually Jewish, we know that. And Reza, the man whose book I read, talks about how important that is because Jesus was here, he was Jewish, and he was here for Jewish people, and most of the time he was talking to the Jewish people. He was really trying to bring his message to them, and to the point that sometimes he won't go, like there's a Samaritan woman who wants him to go to her people, and he won't do it. Which you think, oh my gosh, no, you should do it. But that particular story in the Bible says he won't do it. He was there for the Jews, and that was the whole point. Now, everything that we read in the Bible, as you'll see as I keep going on, you have to take with a bit of salt because it depends on the writer. What was the intent of the writer, and why did they write it that way, and who were they writing to? So you have to look at all those things. So you don't always get the picture of who Jesus was. I should say you.
I don't always get the picture of who Jesus was from reading the Bible. It's actually hard. But the end of my talk tonight, hopefully you'll feel a little bit more uplifted about Jesus. But reading the Bible actually can be really hard to find out who is this Jesus, because you have these layers of people who've written it and the times that it was happening and how long ago it was. So the language that Jesus spoke was Aramaic. The Bible, however, was not written in his language. It was written in Greek for the most part. All of the writers were writing in Greek, I believe. There was something about some of the letters that we'll be looking at may have been written in some other language, but for the most part written in Greek. Jesus had four brothers that are mentioned in the Bible. I don't have their names, but they're not that important, excepting one of them. And several sisters. Now, the Catholics don't agree with that.
No. I was just going to say, how do you know this?
Well, the Bible over and over and over again says his brother this, his brother that, his brother this, his brother that. It's mentioned, the several sisters is mentioned in the Bible. Catholics, and remember I was Catholic for a long time, Catholics say that the word brother or sister really referred to cousins, that there are close relations and not really siblings. You know, which way you want to go on that. There is, though, one of the brothers of Jesus was James. Now, the funny thing, in the Bible, it looks like they have about five names, and they use those five names over and over and over again. So we'll see, even here, we're going to see, you know, there are a couple of different Jameses. But the James who was the apostle was not Jesus' brother. It was another man named James. They called James the Just. And that was actually the brother of Jesus, the oldest brother. And he became the leader in the church. And he led the new Christian church. After the death of Jesus, he led the Christian church for the next 30 years or so, along with Paul and the other people who were leading the church.
And not Peter. I thought Peter was on.
Peter was there leading the church, right? But James was actually the real head. Peter was there, you know, leading and helping. But James was the one that they actually would go to if they had questions, if they needed something. Paul was also very, very strong, very, very powerful in the early church, and left his mark on almost everything that was written, it seems. But my point with James is that, why is it we don't see much about James? And my understanding from the stuff that I've read is that the idea of Mary being a perpetual virgin came up. The idea that Mary was not only was Jesus, came through a virgin birth, but that she was always a virgin through the rest of her life and before Jesus was born, meant that he didn't have any brothers. And so the Catholics then needed to get rid of this guy who kept saying that he was the brother of Jesus. So you see very, very little written about James. James the Just. Go look him up. It'll say that he was the brother of Jesus. The other thing that, when I'm talking about absolute historical facts, that he was baptized by John the Baptist. What an odd thing for them to say. It was an absolute fact. But apparently Flavius Josephus was one of the old historians, and actually some of his historical writings, because he was writing around the 1st, 2nd century, some of his writings were actually changed, which I found really interesting and sad, by people in the church who wanted to put forth a particular view. But for the most part, I think that his writings were preserved as he actually wrote them. But it's recorded that John the Baptist was there. John the Baptist was probably one of the Essenes, which is one of four different groups of Jews at the time. Instead of jumping around, and I have to apologize for that, but the information you have to jump around. So there are four different groups of Jews: Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Essenes, and another group that I'm going to call the Insurrectionists. And the Essenes were a group of people who lived in the mountains. A lot of them lived away from other people. They some of them were monks and, you know, just lived a very, very austere life. There are some saying that the Essenes actually did have family groups with them. That's all up in question. But then when we look at the way that John lived, and John came out of the mountains and apparently came out from that area where they knew, I think Qumran was an area where the Essenes were staying, and he came out, I believe, from that area And he, you know, wouldn't eat certain things or would only eat a few things. The Essenes were that way. You know, he didn't have many clothes on. The Essenes were really strict. The Essenes did a lot of had a lot of water rituals, and John was baptizing people, which was a water ritual. Now, interesting, the baptizing that John did was not to remove sins. Who knew? Because nowadays, when a baptism happens, it's to remove sins. And even with a tiny baby, you know, that's why Catholics, in fact, baptize a baby, because of original sin, the sin that you were born with from Adam, so they baptize the baby to cleanse them of that sin. But those concepts actually came much later. I was reading that St. Augustine was one of the people who brought up this idea of original sin, which was interesting. Anyway, so John was baptizing, and John then baptized Jesus. One of the comments about that, when you read in the Bible, one of the books will say that John, that Jesus asked to be baptized, you know, that it's the right thing to do, and that John didn't want to do it because he knew that Jesus was above him. And that's, again, putting forth the point of view, trying to explain why is it that Jesus was being baptized. If Jesus was ahead, why was John baptizing him? Yeah. Yogananda actually has brought us some information about these two people. Yogananda has said that in a past incarnation, that Jesus was a prophet named Elias, and Joseph and John the Baptist was a prophet named Elijah. And that at that time, in the past, Elijah was the guru of Elias. And then now, at this time, when they came again, John the Baptist said, no, you're the Messiah, and you're the one who is above me. So they flipped that role. Okay. And then the other thing that we know is that Jesus was crucified by the Romans, and that is well documented, that it really did happen. And for several reasons, sometimes the Bible tries to show that it was because of the priests who were looking out for themselves and their money, that they actually did it, but it actually was the Romans who did it. And there are several reasons why the early church tried to show that it was not the Romans, because they were under Roman rule. No, it wasn't the Romans. We like you guys. You guys are okay. It really was the priests. They were the ones who caused it. But the priests, they could have stoned Jesus to death, but they couldn't crucify him. So, more about that later. So, first century Jerusalem, what was it like? Apparently, there was a lot of insurrection or a lot of turmoil. And when I was reading some of this stuff, I was thinking about the condition of our world today, you know, and how many things are going on. And the city of Jerusalem, okay, I wanted to get some pictures that would kind of show it, sort of get an idea of what the city of Jerusalem may have looked like. It had been under Jewish rule maybe 1,000 years before with King David, and the Jews always wanted to go back to that. They felt that we are the chosen people of God, and we should not be under someone else's rule. These Romans, they should not be ruling us. And yet they were. They had their thumb so tightly on the Jewish people until Reza, the man who wrote the book Zealot, said that even the priestly garments that were needed for particular ceremonies that the Jews would do, you know, at the different times, the Romans would hold on to the garments, time for the ceremony, you give it to them, you know, during those days of the holiday, you give them their garments, and they would put them on and use them, and then they would have to give them back. So the Romans were really, you know, really tight down on them. And so it was, the Jews just felt that this was not right. And so you had these people wanting to overthrow. There actually was, continual problems. They wanted to overthrow Rome. So there was then a group of insurrectionists with several messiahs. Many times, apparently, some young person would come up and say, I'm the messiah, and I'm going to overthrow, and would have people around them. apparently they were for different reasons. Some wanted to rule now, you know, believing that heaven on earth is going to happen now, and others were saying that that it's a different kind, you know, that God is going to come and it's not going to be really on earth, but it's going to be different. But there were several messiahs. Who knew? You know, that idea. But usually what would happen, Rome would get wind of it, they would find the person, they would execute the person, and then that movement would disappear. But in this case, in the case of Jesus, it didn't happen. When, you know, but I'm getting way ahead of myself. So, here's another picture of Rome, now of Jerusalem. Now, I'm going to show you one more picture of Jerusalem. This one is Jerusalem during the Middle Ages. But this next picture of Jerusalem is when Jerusalem was destroyed. And in the year 66, so Jesus died, you know, Jesus was born in 4 BC, so he died around 28, 29 of the Common Era, right? And in the year 66, so we're talking about 50-some years later, in the year 66, the Jewish people revolted against the Romans and really had it going. And for 4 years, they were able to control Jerusalem for 4 years. And then the Romans came in and in the year 70 and destroyed, absolutely destroyed the city, leaving not one stone standing on top of the other. And the people were decimated, were absolutely decimated. And those that were not killed were carried off to be slaves and whatever. I mean, they absolutely destroyed the city. That was the year 70, and that has never been rebuilt. Or part of it had. Well, the city of Jerusalem, of course. But the Western Wall, they used to call the Wailing Wall, was one of the walls that was left standing after that decimation, after the destruction of Jerusalem. And that destruction actually started from the temple. It's a story that is really powerful. I would actually like to read more about it. Or, you know, it's unfortunate we don't, you know, we have these stories about the parting of the Red Sea, but we almost never see a story about what happened to the Jewish people at that time. And your heart just goes out to this group of people who have been so oppressed over and over and over again. You want to ask, you know, why? But I don't know. So now we're going to be looking at the Gospels. The information that we have that is factual is really limited to those few things that I've already talked about. But there's a lot of other information from the Bible that may or may not be true. And we're looking only at the New Testament, so that's the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And then the fifth, actually, is the Acts of the Apostles, which is sort of like part two of Luke, probably written by the same person. Now, there's always a question of who wrote them, where did they get the information from, and who were they writing to? So you see, I've handed out for you guys an information sheet with that. You don't have to look at it right now. You don't really need it, or you can hold on to it if you want to. So even though we always say the four Gospels as, what are they? The four Gospels? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That's the way they go. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The first one, actually, that was written was Mark and not the others. It was the first one written. And then when Matthew and Luke wrote their Gospels, they used Mark. You know, they would look at what he had to say and then they would write what they had to say about it. And they looked at what he had to say and they would write. But they also used something else that's called Q. It comes from the word quelle, which means source. And they don't know, you know, the research can't get their hands on exactly what that is, but they know that Matthew and Luke used another source, probably written, it had to be a written source. It didn't have to be, but it was from what they say of Q, that it was a written source. Because they can see that Matthew and Luke say the same stories, and some of the stories that they say are not in Mark. So So you can see here the blue from Q are in both of those, but not in Mark. One of the things that I think Reza was saying is that Mark's gospel is the shortest of the four, and it's the most just to the point. You know, it has a lot of the things that Jesus said, but it doesn't have much flower and story. It doesn't have the Christmas stories, and it doesn't have those kinds of things. It doesn't talk much about what happened after Jesus died, you know. So Matthew and Luke wanted to solve that problem. So they both include a Christmas story, and they include a lot more at the end of it, you know, to embellish it and make it more, you know, a story-like, I think. And then apparently they have other parts that are slightly different between the two of them. So in Mark, you can see that brown at the top just shows the part that is unique to Mark and that's not in the other two. That means the other two had it, but they didn't put in what Mark had said at that point, and it's just a small part. Anyway, you have this one, so you can look at that later on. Okay. So Mark was the first written around the year 60, between 66 and 70. So that means that this was just around the time that, when the Jews had, you know, had taken Jerusalem back, or he wrote that book at the end of that, when the Jews lost the war and the Romans had, you know, sacked the city. We don't know exactly when it happened, you know, when actually it happened. The author of Mark was not the gospel named Mark. It was probably someone else. There is a man named John Mark, but he probably was not the author of the gospel. And that is something that when you go on the internet, you're going to find most, how shall I say it, evangelical Christians, from my understanding, believe that those books were written by those men whose names they hold. But the research shows that this is not true. And they also, many times people say that they were eyewitnesses, but this also is not true. The time when they were written, if you look at the time that they were, how far that is to the future, unless they lived well into their 70s, 80s, 90s, and in the case of John, into his hundreds, they didn't write those books. So Mark was first. Matthew and Luke were written right around the same time. But they were not together, and it wasn't like they collaborated to write theirs. They were writing them separately, both writing at the same time. And you can see that their language in all cases was Greek. Now, who they were writing to makes a difference, because the way that you present something, you're influenced by who you're writing it to and who you want to influence and in what way. So Matthew's audience was the Jewish people. Mark was writing for the Romans. Which is interesting, because it was being the first, and that's really interesting. And Luke was writing to the Gentiles, the Gentiles being those who did not follow the Jewish faith, and John also. Now, then the sources, you'll see under Matthew it says the Septuagint, Mark, and Q. And the Septuagint was the Jewish sayings, the Jewish beliefs translated into Greek. So the Jewish Bible, the Old Testament, especially the first five books of the Old Testament, was originally written in Hebrew. But when Matthew and Luke were using it, they were using the translated version. So they were not using the Hebrew, rather using the Greek of the same book. And then the Acts, I said down here at the bottom, just because I ran out of space, so it was like the second book of Luke, and so what applies to Luke pretty much applies to the Acts of the Apostles. And John was the one odd fellow out. The other three are called the word slips away from me, what is it? They are called synoptic gospels. The first three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are called the synoptic gospels because they're pretty much the same. The stories are the same for a large part, not always. The order of the stories is very much the same. You can just see that, and their sources are similar. But John, the Gospel of John, is really different. It starts off really different. It just, really different. The birth story the nativity story only occurs in Matthew and Luke, so Mark didn't have it and John didn't have it. So here we go, yeah. So I just picked out some of the things that you can see compare. So the nativity story happens only in Matthew and Luke. The baptism happens in 3 but not in John. Story of the fishes and the loaves, we'll get to that in a few minutes, was told 5 times, twice in Matthew. Whether or not the Lord's Supper happened on Passover or before Passover was the same with 3 of them and different day before Passover under John. And then the post-resurrection, whether or not the gospel talked about what happened after the resurrection. Okay. St. Paul. The story around Paul is that he was persecuting the Jewish people. This was after the time of Jesus. So Jesus had, at this point, had already passed away, already died, been killed on the cross. And Paul, you know, was not happy with the Jews, and he was not happy with the Christians, and he was persecuting. He was going from place to place and gathering them up and bringing them back to be tried or whatever. He was on the road from Jerusalem to Damascus. And he was struck down and became blind all of a sudden. And in that process, he was blind for 3 days, and then someone was able to cure him and fix his eyes. During that 3 days, he had a vision of Jesus. He felt that he met the living Christ. Jesus had already died. That I can't remember what year that happened. And so he converted. He was, you know, was just so taken in with that experience of meeting and, you know, feeling that he really got to know the living Christ from that experience. So he converted immediately. Now, sometimes his name you'll see in the Bible is Saul, S-A-U-L, the Tarsus. And then people think, well, that he became Paul because after he converted. And actually, it was not true from what I was reading, but that Paul is actually a Greek translation of the same name. Saul. Paul was really, really, really important in the development of the Christian church, or the development of the Jewish people as they became Christians. He influenced them tremendously because he did a lot of the early writing. So Paul, one of the things that happened was that churches were developed here and there, and Paul wrote letters to the different churches for different reasons. So we have what we call epistles. And you have this in your book. You can't really see it very clearly from there, but it includes the name of the epistle, who wrote it, and who it was talking to. So that makes a difference, and the year that it was written. So these were all written before the very first Gospels. The very first Gospel written between 66 and 70. These were all written. Let's see, the earliest of this one is 49. So we're talking about maybe 40 or 50 years after the death of Jesus when the epistles were being written. And they were written to these different churches trying to help the people solve problems. Sometimes the problems were relatively simple, like one of the things, this again comes from Father Jack, that the Bible, one of the epistles says that women should not speak out in church. What's that about? Well, Father Jack, being the way that he was, would tell us the reason was that the Jewish people separated women from men. Women on one side, men on the other side. And the women sometimes would say, "Hey, Saul, what do they mean by such and such?" Talking all the way across. So that correction was that women should not do that. Not saying that women couldn't be priests or leaders or ministers. In fact, there were women who were priests and leaders. Not they were priests, but leaders in the early church. But that's what that epistle was talking about. And other things that I remember from my own reading many, many years ago, that sometimes people would, you know, they celebrated the Eucharist, which is that ceremony that actually occurs in every one of the Gospels, the ceremony of the bread and the wine, that when Jesus at the Last Supper took the bread and broke it and gave it to his disciples and said, "Eat this, this is my body." And he took the wine and he said, "Drink this, this is my blood." And at that time, they say, many people stopped walking with him and thought, "This is weird. This is too much for me." And so many of the disciples, not the apostles, but the disciples who were other people that were following him, said, "Enough of that." But And then as the church went on, they would repeat that ceremony. And still today, you know, of course, if you go to a Catholic church or any church, they repeat that same ceremony. But in the early church, sometimes they were doing the ceremony and drinking a little too much. And so a letter might be sent to correct them. You know, when you come, the ceremony is for the ceremony, not for you to drink as much as you can. You know, eat ahead of time, and then come and just have a reasonable amount. So the letters were practical letters, and then there were also letters that were inspiring the people and correcting beliefs and teaching them and so forth. So Paul wrote, of the 14 letters there, Paul wrote 6 or 7 of them. There are a few that were disputed. And there are several that were pseudo-writers. We don't know who wrote them, but they said that they were from Paul, so they may have been people who were under Paul, students of Paul's. But so for the most part, he wrote them. There are 2 or 3, I don't see a letter to Peter, but I thought that there was an epistle to Peter, but I don't see it, so, thanks. Okay, the birth story. So, and this, now we're going to go into the second part of what I'm doing for this evening, which is to look at some of the Bible stories, and, you know, I'll do some telling of what really happened, or what was really going on, or what they meant here, so... So Mary and Joseph on their way to Bethlehem to... Do you remember why they were going to Bethlehem? To pay taxes, right, yeah. Everybody had to go to the city of their ancestry, and Bethlehem was the ancestry city of David, King David. And so they needed to go there to pay taxes in the city that their family was originally from. And so Joseph was apparently originally from the family of David, and there in the Bible they actually have the genealogy, so-and-so begat so-and-so, so-and-so begat so-and-so. It goes a long, long, boring list. I remember when I was a kid in Sunday school and had to read all these names and you couldn't pronounce them, and you know, it didn't say anything interesting, but that was to show the genealogy, to show that Joseph was related to David, to King David, and that was why they went back to Bethlehem. So the baby was born there. Now, hold on to your seats. Because Reza says the baby was probably not born there. Now, there's certain things that we know, you know, that we celebrate Christmas in the winter. And we know that it probably happened, the birth of the baby probably happened in the springtime, because that was, or the spring or the summer, early summer, because the shepherds were out with their fields, out in the fields watching their sheep. And in the wintertime, they would not have been. And we can accept that, okay, that it was changed to December, probably because there were other pagan rituals that happened in December, and by the Christians using the same date, it, you know, would bring the people in. So there were reasons for that. Well, there actually is a reason for saying that they went to Bethlehem instead of saying the baby was born in Nazareth. Remember, it's Jesus the Nazarene, right? The Nazarene, that was where their family was. And if we go back to that other picture, you'll see that Nazareth was up at the top of the lake, and Bethlehem was way down at the bottom, and why would they go so far? And as Reza was saying, okay, you're going for taxes, someone's got to look at what you've got to decide on what your taxes are, right? You certainly can't bring all of your animals and all of your household things. You can't bring all that stuff for them to look at it. So it would make more sense for the tax collector to go to where you live, look at what you got, and, you know, decide on your taxes there. But the story says they came to Bethlehem because they needed to show that the Messiah, Jesus, was related to David. Because the Old Testament says that the Messiah will come from the lineage of David. And so the story says it that way. You know, and it's, you know, and the story is beautiful, so we can keep the story, but you just know they probably was born in Nazareth instead of in Bethlehem. I hope I'm not ruining all those Christmas stories. We'll be thinking, oh, that lady said that, and blah!
As long as
okay.
We still have the story.
What?
As long as we still have the story.
Yes, we still have the story. I'm telling you, we don't have to let go of the stories. I love all the stories and the Christmas music. So the middle years, from the time, it's actually, well, how many years was it? 18 years that we don't know what happened to Jesus, because, okay, so he was born in Bethlehem or in Nazareth, wherever, and then the story says that his family had to flee to Egypt for a short period of time because King Herod was killing all the baby boys. And so he fled. And that story also, unfortunately, is not, you know, there's no record of Herod doing that. Herod was a Jewish person. He was a king of the Jews, actually. And he was really, really, a bad guy who would kill people and stuff. But they didn't record him ever having this particular time of killing all the babies in Bethlehem. So they say, well, you know, it probably didn't happen. But anyway, in the story, the family goes to Egypt because, again, the Old Testament says the Messiah will come out of Egypt. So they stayed there, and when everything was clear, when there was no longer any danger, when Herod was dead, then they came back and were able to live in Nazareth. So during the time they're living in Nazareth, then Jesus, actually, was at that time? It's either when they were coming back from Egypt or it was when they were coming back from Bethlehem. It had to be when they were coming from Egypt, because Jesus was about 12 years old and they were traveling a whole caravan of people, and they'd been traveling for 3 days, and all of a sudden his parents said, "Where's Jesus?" "Well, I thought he was with cousin so-and-so." No, he's not with me. "I thought he was with cousin so-and-so." "No, he's not with me." Then parents realized that they had left him back in whatever, I'm not sure if it was Egypt, I can't remember right now. So then they went back to get him, and they found Jesus in the temple, teaching. This 12-year-old kid. And what Reza also brings out is that he was probably illiterate. Being illiterate does not mean that you wouldn't know the Bible, though, or you wouldn't, the Old Testament, or that you wouldn't know the stories, or that you wouldn't have wisdom, because we have current-day saints who can't read. Ananda Moy Ma is one of the saints in India who, apparently during her lifetime couldn't read or write, but people would go to her for interpretation of the Gita because she knew the Gita well and, had so much wisdom in that, But anyway, so I got myself off track. So at that point then, Jesus' family found him. He said, "I have to be about my father's business." But they brought him back home, and then the Bible stops there with, he continued to grow in grace and wisdom. So he just lived the next 18 years, they're saying, right there. But actually, there are several indications now that he didn't. Now, this man, Nicholas Notovich, was one of the people who went to India and found evidence that he actually had gone to India and lived there for 18 years, that he did his sadhana under the gurus of India. And that's why it's interesting. Sometimes if you look, you'll see great similarities between the teachings of the New Testament, the teachings of Jesus, and the teachings of the Gita. These things are there. We don't have much more information on it, of what happened during the time he was there. But if you Google it, you'll find that they actually came up with written documents. In India, they used the name Issa. ISSA is what Jesus was called in India. And apparently lived there for those 18 years and then returned. So the next time he shows up in the Bible is when he is 30 and he is then going to be baptized. So these are his years of ministry then. So here's John baptizing him in the water of Jordan. And again, this was not to get rid of his sins. And it's kind of tricky because I think we ordinarily associate baptism with getting rid of your sins, but it was more a cleansing kind of thing. I'm not sure what they decided that it was actually for. So, that was the beginning of his ministry. One of the early things that he did was to gather his apostles. Now, I've on purpose had these two words, apostles and disciples, because most of the time we say the disciples and we mean the 12. The disciples 12. But actually, the 12 were apostles. People who walked with Jesus. Disciples, they say he had 72 disciples. So this would include the women and other men who were following him, who were, his supporters, who were helping him and so forth, who were working with Jesus, all of these disciples. And he may have actually, if you think about the thousands that were following him in other ways, you may even call it even more than that. But disciples, he might just say those who were traveling with him, actually. Okay, I don't know if you want to even bother, but here are the names of the apostles. Peter up there at the top left, James, the brother of John. This is not the brother of Jesus. Simon Peter, and so of course you may or may not know, I guess, that his name was Simon, and Jesus then changed his name to Peter later on. Bartholomew, I'm down on this side. Matthew at the bottom. Some people would say that this is Matthew, the gospel writer. The evidence doesn't suggest that, but perhaps that the gospel, the apostle may have influenced the gospel writer, may have been influenced by him. Up at the top on the right is another James. See, remember I was saying that there are like five names and they use those same five names over and over again. Again, that's not the brother of Jesus because he was not one of the apostles. Judas Iscariot. And there's actually another Judas, but he has another name in here. I'm not sure if it's the John, but I was surprised to see another Judas. Then in the middle is Thaddeus and Andrew next to him. Oh, Simon and Peter. That's right here. Simon and Peter are two separate guys. But Simon Peter is also the name of Peter, of Simon, and John on the far right-hand side. And that is John, for whom the last gospel was written. Again, the big question, did John, because the story is that John was exiled to an island, Patmos, off of the country of Greece? Where is Patmos? Is it Italy?
Around.
Turkey, okay. And that he lived there for the end of his life. But he also was the person to whom Jesus gave his mother to take care of his mother. So he would have had to be really, really old. I mean, a lot of people say that, no, John wrote that last gospel and the book Revelations, which is the last book of the Bible. But he would have had to live a really, really, really long time, because the gospel of John was written between the year 90 and 110. And so he would have had it well over 100. Maybe it's possible, but it's not essential. But, who knows. So, Mary Magdalene. This is apparently a really modern view of Mary from the movies or something. And what was her relationship with Jesus? And there are lots of stories out there, that Mary and Jesus had a thing going on. I think something in the Bible says at one point, Jesus, why do you kiss her on the lips and you kiss us on the cheek? So that's actually in the Bible. But from my readings, Mary was probably in her 60s, 50s or 60s, still young. But not that romantic relationship. Mary Magdalene also was not a prostitute. Very often people will read and think that she was a prostitute, but there is, there are like three or four Marys, and they say Mary, and then you think it was her. The woman who was putting oil on Jesus' feet and then washing her hair, a woman, Mary, but apparently not this same Mary. Yeah, Mary who was the brother of Lazarus. Lazarus was raised from the dead. Not this same Mary. I mean, it is really, really confusing because you have the same name and they don't put a last name with it. Mary is Mary Magdalene because she was from the city of Magdala. I think at the first slide we saw where that was. But she, if history is correct, was really powerful and important. She was actually the first person to see the risen Christ. Now, what under the sun about the egg? I saw that and I was like, what is that? And then I saw several more pictures. If you look for pictures of Mary Magdalene, you will find this egg. And what under the sun is going on? Well, apparently, when she went to the crypt, to where Jesus was buried, she had a basket of eggs. They don't explain why. Maybe she was going to have lunch afterwards. I was also thinking that the Jewish ceremony involves eggs. The Passover involves the use of an egg. So I thought maybe she was on her way to, finish the ceremony or whatever. She had a basket of eggs with her, and the eggs turned bright red after Jesus left. Jesus appeared to her, and then left, and then the eggs turned bright red. So she's very often depicted. This egg happens to be white, but many of the pictures you'll find, and sometimes they say that the whole basket turned colorful. So now, the next time you do Easter eggs, you can think about Mary Magdalene, that the story was related to her. Who knew? Because we're always thinking, well, the Easter Bunny, yes. Where do the eggs come from? Possibly from this. So, but she was an important person in the early church. There are no writings attributed to her name. She didn't write any herself, but she was considered the apostle's apostle because she brought the news back to the apostles of Jesus having risen from the dead. Okay, our time, I can't believe the time is going this fast. Let's skip over that. So we're going to look at more stories. Okay, the wedding feast at Cana. This was the first miracle that Jesus did. He went to a wedding with his mother. So this picture of the woman there is supposed to be his mother. And you don't, Jesus, I think, is one off to the side that you can't really see. And the person who was throwing the party, you know, a rich man, ran out of wine. And I think the steward who was handling these things, you know, approached Mary and said, "You run out of wine, what are you going to do?" And so Mary turns to her son and says, "You're out of wine. Can you help him out?" And Jesus says, "Woman, it's not my time. What is this to me? What am I supposed to do?" And Mary tells the guy, "Do whatever he says. Just follow what he says to do." And sure enough, Jesus said, okay. So he took them to where there were several huge clay pots. He said, "Fill all these pots with water." Okay. And then he took some of the water out and put it into a cup and gave it and said, "Take that to the head steward or whoever. Let him taste it." And he said, "Wow, most people use the best wine first when people are still, you know, alert. And they save the worst wine for the end when people are drunk and they won't know the difference. But you've done the reverse. You've saved the best wine for last. My gosh, you know." So that was the first miracle, changing the water into wine. Now, skeptics like me always say something like, "Yeah, but you know, I mean, it's a clay pot. Okay, it's been holding wine all this time, right? You put some water in it, and you taste it, and you're drunk anyway, you know. So, you know, so it tastes like wine. It tastes really good because it has a light flavor to it. I don't know. Maybe it's not a miracle. But you can believe it's a miracle." And probably the more important message here was the relationship between Mary and Jesus. That Mary knew that Jesus. I think that, you know, again, remembering that the Bible stories are written for that underneath message, that deeper message, and showing that Mary knew that Jesus was really special, that he had something, and then Jesus alluding to the fact that something is going to happen around wine, and wine then is connected to Jesus because it represents his blood. So when he's saying, you know, "It's not my time," he's referring to that Last Supper when he gave the wine and said, "Drink my blood." Okay, feeding the 5,000. So in this story, the disciples were with Jesus, and they had, you know, the story is repeated 5 times in the Bible. And you want to ask, how is it there are 4 Gospels and it's told 5 times? So I think I showed you before in the other earlier slide that Matthew tells the story twice, and he tells it almost exactly the same way, and you wonder, don't ask me, I don't know why he does that. The books are not written in a normal way. But so the men are, they're all together, not just the men, but the men and the women, and they leave the group and go away to a mountain, but the people follow them. So now you have this humongous crowd of people, 5,000 people. Some gospels say 4,000, others say 5,000. Anyway, and they have them sitting down in groups of 50. So the disciples say to Jesus, "Let the people go home. Tell them all to go home because we're out here in the middle of nowhere. They can't get anything to eat. Tell them all to go home. And then, you know, we'll continue tomorrow." And Jesus said, "No, you guys feed them." And "What are we going to feed them with? I don't have anything." "You can feed them. You can feed them." And so they gathered together and got, the Gospels are all a little bit different. Some say that they had 5 fish, some say they had 7, some say they had 5 loaves of bread, some 7. It doesn't matter. They gathered all this and showed it to Jesus, and Jesus blessed it and passed it out. And it fed the 5,000, and they gathered together 12 more baskets of food. So where did, I mean, you know, they started off with just 5 fishes and 2 loaves of bread or whatever. And they came back and they had 12 baskets. How did that happen? So the skeptic in me is, well, first of all, everybody had something, and they said, I'm not sharing. Oh, here's some, okay, well, I have some. You know the story Stone Soup? Have you heard the story? It's a little kid's story about Stone Soup, where people say, oh, no, I don't have anything, and then everyone's, oh, well, I do have some tomatoes, and they'll put it in the pot. Oh, yeah, I have a couple of onions, I'll put it in the pot, and before you know it, they have a delicious soup. I'm thinking the same thing in this story. You know, everybody had a little something they were holding on to it. And, you know, the miracle is that people were able to share, right? Father Jack, that same priest, who would blow us out of the water by saying, nah, it wasn't that way. Nah. He stopped us dead on this one. He said, uh-uh, no. You can't reason away every miracle. He said, this one was retold 5 times. This one you've got to take. How it happened? Why it happened? I don't know. But it's one of my favorite now because of that.
Is that how you use a pizza?
Manna.
It looks like a pizza.
No, this story actually is one of my absolute favorites, and I have a very close, you know, internal connection to this. So the woman was bleeding. 12 years was bleeding, you know, her menstruation bleeding, and couldn't stop it. And they were in a group of people all around Jesus, you know, pushing and shoving or whatever, just, you know, along with his disciples going somewhere. And this woman knew, she knew that if I could just touch his robe, then this bleeding will stop. And so she did, she reached out. I thought this picture was just wonderful because it just absolutely captures it. So she touched it and immediately could feel that her body had changed, and she knew that she'd been healed. And Jesus' response, you know, if you can imagine, there are people all around him. His response was, who touched me? And his disciples, what are you talking about? Who touched you? Everybody is touching you. Everyone's all around you. Everyone, no. I felt the power go out of me. Who touched me? And the woman said, Lord, it was me. You know? And he said, your faith has healed you. Wonderful messages there, you know, that your faith healing you. But also to me, a wonderful, it brings Jesus to me into humanity. Even though this is a great miracle, how did it happen? But for some reason, the fact that he turned and wanted to know what happened, I felt it, says to me that there was something that really, really happened. There was some energy that passed from him to her, that was drawn from him to her, willingly given, but drawn into her. And so this actually is one of my most favorite. There are many, many healings. In fact, they said that Jesus was not the only one who was healing people. The Messiah is all over the place for healing, which I find kind of odd, you know, but, the times, I don't know. Or maybe they understood the relationship between the herbs and the energy and the illnesses, I don't know, but they say that, and this is Reza talking, Reza, the guy who doesn't believe anything, said that there were a lot of healings. It was common for there to be people out there who were healers. The unusual thing about Jesus was everyone else was charging. Jesus was doing it for free. Said that was the unusual thing, and people were just, you know, would flock to him, partly because he was a successful healer, but also because he was not charging for it. You know? So there were many different kinds of healings. And, you know, what he's saying over and over again is your faith has healed you, your sins are forgiven, things that you know, must have sparked a lot of question and, you know, why are you saying that? But, okay, our time is so far gone. I'm not going to go through all of these. Cleansing the temple was when Jesus went into the temple and got rid of the people who were changing money because they were not being honest. The Jewish people couldn't touch the Roman money at a particular time when they were doing sacrifices. They had to have special money, and they had to, you know, there were a lot of rituals around that. And so Jesus came in and overturned their money tables and got rid of the animals and so forth. So, Transfiguration. Jesus was with three of the disciples, and he all of a sudden, his body and his clothing changed to full light. And then with him were two people. One was Moses and the other was Elijah. Remember Elijah in later incarnations was John. And actually, people had asked, you know, was Elijah John? Or was John Elijah in a past life? But it was interesting to me that the people, the disciples, were still really grounded in concrete world. They wanted to know, should we build a special temple for you guys here? Well, they weren't. I would have been blown away. What would you feel like if you were here and seeing this? You know, if you were sitting there and saw that someone had turned to light and was, you know, even if they were not standing in the sky, actually, I think they're standing on a little mound. They're not really in the sky in this picture, even. But and that you'd seen these two, you would have just thought, what under the sun is going on here? So the disciples didn't always understand really what was going on. Another thing I'm just going to throw in here is that the disciples were mentioned very few times in the Bible. They're listed in, I think, the three synoptic gospels. I'm not sure all three of them list them. But they're not listed the same, and they're almost never mentioned later on. And they really are not mentioned, for the most part, in the epistles. James the Just, the brother of Jesus, is mentioned in the epistles. But the other apostles are not. That could be partly because Paul, who was not one of the original disciples, Paul, remember, didn't become you know, it's hard to say if he was a Christian, because the Christian church had not been established. He was not a Hebrew Christian or a Jewish person following Jesus at the time. Paul did so much of the writing, and he controlled so much of what happened in the Bible, and he, for some reason, did not include those other apostles. I think either he didn't feel what they were doing was important, or they didn't, but I understand that almost all of them, with the exception of John, died from crucifixion or from, you know, were killed in some way. So they were out there spreading the word, but they were not mentioned in the Bible beyond that. Crucifixion. So, this was a really common way of handling not just anybody, but the insurrectionists. If you were being crucified, it was because you were trying to make trouble and you were trying to overtake Rome, and Rome felt threatened. So for other kinds of crimes, like being a thief, would not have been crucified. But we're always told that Jesus was crucified with two thieves. But the word in Greek for thief is also the word for bandit. Bandit. And apparently a bandit is what the insurrectionists were called. They were referred to as bandits. So these two guys actually were not thieves, but actually bandits. And then the title that they put on the king of the Jews was very common, that they would put some sign, not particularly that title, but they would put the title of whatever you claim to be. So if you claim to be Messiah, I guess they would put that, or some. They would put what was your crime? They were getting rid of you, they were executing you, and so they would also put the crime. Reza also says that crucifixion was not necessarily to kill you. That sometimes it was actually to deter other people who might be thinking in that direction. So they might kill you first and then hang your body up there. And they, yeah. That's why this one doesn't have anything that you can see. I thought all that was really interesting. Okay. Now, we almost have no time left. Post-resurrection. So Jesus appears then to his people the first time. He, take a look at this picture and see where the nail was. Usually we show it in the center of the hand, and actually it was probably down around the wrist, because if we're in the center of the hand, the body would not have supported it for any length of time at all. It would just slip through, but right. I know. Yes. So, and the man who probably is greeting Jesus there on the left is probably Thomas. So Thomas is very often called Doubting Thomas, because he said when the disciples first were together, they were together in this room, and Jesus just appeared in their midst, you know, walked through the wall. Who knows? They knew that he had, you know, I mean, they knew that he had been crucified. He comes in, and so they're so surprised. And then somehow, I forget now exactly what happened, Thomas was not with them and said, I don't believe it. I don't believe he's, I don't believe it. If I don't see him and put my hands in his wound, I'm not going to believe it. And then he came. Jesus came again and said, okay, here, put your hands in my side wound. Put your hands here. Here. It's really me. And it was the risen Jesus in human and body form. And so here he's having a meal with all of them together. When I look at them, the thing that seems wrong to me about this picture is their faces should be like, whoa. You know, it's just total amazement. Here he is just sitting there like he used to be. The other thing that I'm just now noticing on the picture is the picture doesn't have the wounds. So, I don't know. This one is a story that I had never heard as a child. I think I heard it first when Asha was telling the story about Jesus frying fish. And then looking in the Bible about it, it was actually the story connected to him walking on the water, that Jesus, is it connected to him walking on the water? I think there are a couple of different stories, and one of the times he was actually walking across the water. But the men were fishing, and they had been fishing all day, and they couldn't catch any fish. And Jesus says, put your nets out on this other side, and they put the nets over, and they're taking this huge amount. And he says, come on, and I'll feed you guys. And so here he is, frying fish. And when Asha tells the story, it's like, it's so such a funny thing to think of Jesus having a fish fry. You know? Again, it makes him very human. It makes him a person that you just want to be with. Can you just imagine what they're saying to him? What should we do next? Where should we go? And what should we do? And apparently he did, give some instruction. I think that Saint Thomas, who ended up in India, said that the risen Christ told him that that's where his mission was, and that's what he did. He went off and, I think spent most of the rest of his life in India, not all of it. Okay, another one of my favorite stories on the road to Emmaus. So, in this story, these two men are walking along, and a third man, the one in the center, comes up and is walking with them. Well, the two guys are talking to each other about, oh, what happened the other day, and oh my gosh, I couldn't believe it, did you see? And there he was hanging there, and then they gave him some vinegar on a sponge, and it was just terrible, oh my gosh, and I was so afraid, I knew we were hiding on the side, I saw the women were there, and these two men are going back and forth with this conversation of what had happened, and Jesus, they didn't know who it was, he was in the middle of them, and he's saying, really, what happened after that? And the two men are like, where have you been? How could you not know what happened? I mean, this is the news all over the place. How could you not know? And they, talking and walking along, and then they get to the town and go in to have the meal. And this, they're having a meal together, and in the breaking of the bread, they recognize Jesus. This is going back to when he said, eat my body and drink my blood. And it was that act. And so before that, their eyes were closed and they couldn't see who he was. His body was changed. Who knows? Somehow they didn't recognize him. But in that act of breaking the bread and sharing it, they recognized him and he was gone. Again, one of my absolute favorite stories. And I don't know why. So, Paramahansa Yogananda has said that he was glad that the religion was not called Jesusism, but rather Christianity, because, let's see, where do I have it? Because the Christ was the important thing, the Christ consciousness. And so let me just read this. I'm glad that Christianity was not called Jesusism. I'm not even saying that right. Because Christianity is a much broader word. There is a difference of meaning between Jesus and Christ. Jesus is the name of a little human body in which the vast Christ consciousness was born. Although the Christ consciousness manifested in the body of Jesus, it cannot be limited to one human form. And this was part of what bothered me as a Christian, that I didn't have the word Christ consciousness, but I knew that Jesus could not be the only time that God had manifested. I knew that it couldn't be. And so here is Paramahansa Yogananda saying exactly that. Although the Christ consciousness manifested in the body of Jesus, it cannot be limited to one human form. it would be a metaphysical error to say that the omnipresent Christ consciousness is circumscribed by the body of one human being. Then Jadava Krishna is the Christ of the Hindus. These two great avatars, Javada, I've never heard of that name in connection with Krishna. Krishna and Jesus, but interesting, he may have used that because of both starting with J, fully manifested the Christ consciousness, the Kutashta Chaitanya, or divine guiding intelligence that is in every atom of creation. But as many as received him, that is, received the universal Christ consciousness, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. So, we got halfway through what I had planned, but we'll have to stop there. I'm glad you guys came. It was really fun sharing with you. Any questions? Where do you start? Oh, good question. Okay, so part of what I was going to talk about was the early Christians in the years shortly after Jesus. And so one of the handouts I gave you is the Desert Fathers. And they were groups of people, men and women, who got together and lived in the desert, lived an austere life. But they were so wise, and they put the teachings of Jesus into practice. They were able to get out of the Bible the depths of teaching, and they were able to put them into practice. And so you'll see those readings in there, the sayings from the Desert Fathers, and that might be a good place to start, just in reading those and seeing the wisdom from them. And the other thing, a book that Paramahansa Yoganandaji actually recommended, is this book, The Imitation of Christ. And so I got the book because I wanted to see what's it all about. And actually you'll find that this also has taken the Bible and put it into readable form. Sometimes in reading the Bible, it's like, what does it mean? You know, and there's that Mary again, in which one it's hard for me to get some meaning out of it and to really get what they were after. This does it. The first part of it maybe is more directed toward people who are monks and nuns, so it's more austere. But the middle section, I think it's either called the second or the third section, is a conversation between a disciple and Jesus. And then it has a reflection. And I just, the other night, just picked it up and just read one of them, and I thought, oh, this one, that applies to me. Yeah, I can see how that applies. This one, I'm going to hang on to this. Yeah. So that's a good place to start, too, Imitation of Christ. This was written by Thomas a Kempis in the 11th century, the 10th century, 11th century, I think, or 12th, somewhere around there. So early on. Okay, guys. Thank you. Wonderful.